Well, welcome to week number 46. This is the podcast that's based upon our newsletter that we write. Remember, this is a newsletter from Rexulam. It's headed by Dawn Riddler and myself, Kirby Lakhranji. We talk about markets, happenings in the political world, and just quite frankly, everything and anything that we find of interest. This really is just a conglomeration of all the information. Please head over to the newsletter. Go and have a read exactly what we're talking about today, or otherwise reach out and have a chat to us. So as I said, week number 46, we're heading into December, into the latter part of this year. And the question is, will there be a Santa rally or won't there? The S&P 500 for the week is up 2.24%. NASDAQ is up by 2.37% for the week. And then the small cap 2000, which is in the United States, was up by 5.23%. Remember, over the years, small caps are still down. That is a sector or a part of the market, the size part of the market that has continued to dwindle as the very large Magnificent Seven has lifted the S&P 500 higher. Crossing Europe, Euro Stoxx 50 for the week is up 3.38%. And Dawn, for the year, the Euro Stoxx 50 is now up 11%. Not so bad for a world where most people thought the wheels would literally just come off in 2023. If we look at bonds, US 2-year bonds is now trading at 489, US 10-year bonds at 443, and US 20 years at 480. So we're kind of seeing this flattening out of the yield curve that has maintained itself. We haven't seen a normalization of the yield curve, but may I say that the CPI ratings and that we saw last week out of the United States, those readings certainly sent the bond market lower from a yield perspective and the prices higher, as people anticipating that perhaps interest rate cuts potentially could be on the cards again. And then very good news for South African investors is the rand dollar is now at 18.34 against the dollar. A lot of investors are saying to me, do I think this is the bottom? I don't know. You can look at technicals, you can look at a whole range of things, but it really depends on where the dollar is going to be going, because there's some dollar weakness that we're sitting with at the moment. And that is just because the CPI report just really came in weaker than expected. And therefore, you're seeing the dollar weakening. And that is what you're seeing in the rand dollar value at 18.34. Does it stay here? Perhaps. Perhaps it goes lower. But this is not a bad time. If you were going to take money out the country and you were going to use your allowance, this is probably not a bad time to be doing something like this. Dawn, you wrote a very interesting piece this week around interest rates. A lot of banks show kind of this very magical number that they show on billboards, like a magic number. Like you could earn 11% by putting your money in the money market. And I think a lot of investors look at that and go, wow, that's wonderful. Why take the risk in the markets? Why be bothered trying to invest if I can just earn 11% in interest by just leaving it in the bank account? But that's probably, you need to understand the fine print in order to understand a little bit more around that 11%. Is that not true?
Yes, Kobe, it's really basically understanding the difference between the nominal interest rate. That is the interest, the annual interest rate that they should all be actually advertising. The effective rate is that if you compound that, in other words, if you plow that interest back into the capital amount and then keep it there for 5 years, then you get an effective interest rate. And on about
8.7%.
you are getting an effective interest rate that is up near 11%. But that is a compound rate and that is over 5 years. And if you want to compare apples with apples, you need to look at what the annual rate is, what that nominal interest rate is. And it is at the high end around about 8.3, 8.4. You might be able to get as high as 8.6% in money market, and that is what it is. And there are a couple of banks that consistently do this and have been doing this for years. And as soon as interest rates get up into the kind of values that we're seeing today, you start seeing these advertisements, and we start getting phone calls from our clients to say, oh, if I can get 11% or 12% or 13% from putting it in the money market, what on earth am I doing investing? And it's understanding some of the nuances behind how the role that interest plays in a portfolio, because this is part of the nuance that Rexulam Invest, quite frankly, is best known for. That's the way we build portfolios, by understanding those yields. So we know and understand the role that yields play, and interest that comes from bond coupons and it comes from money market. It doesn't matter where it comes from. Interest per se are taxed in the same way. You have an allowance, which is pretty pitiful, and it very rarely increases over time, the allowance that SARS gives you. And over and above that, it is taxed at what we call your marginal rate. In other words, you've got your income, and whatever is over and above your income, in other words, the additional interest that you pay, is taxed then at what we call the marginal rate. It doesn't take much for your marginal rate to be up at 40%. It really doesn't. The large swathes of the South African population are up over 40%. You know, you do have to be up in the sort of 1.5 million rand per annum to get into the 45% range. To get into the 40% range is way below that. So you're going to be losing 40% of that interest to SARS, right? That puts a huge hole in that interest that you're seeing there. So this is where the nuances comes in, and this is where the planning comes in, where you actually run different scenarios to say, yes, we need to get yield from interest, but what is the best way to get it? And how should we be handling it? Should it be in an endowment where it's capped at 30%? Should it be in a living annuity where it's now not treated as interest per se, but then it's treated as income? And I go into that in a little bit more detail. And it really would only make sense to you once you go through that sort of scenario planning process as to what exactly you would save by having it. But cashing everything out and putting it into interest just makes no sense.
The other thing, which I think is important and perhaps a lot of people don't understand, is that when we look at investor portfolios, we often look at discretionary money and we look at committed money. Committed money is non-discretionary. Those are things in living annuities, for instance, and retirement annuities and so forth. Those two sources are taxed quite differently. We sat with a client not so long ago, Dawn, that actually listened and then went, oh gosh, I didn't factor that in. So interest is taxed in a discretionary portfolio in your hands. That's the 40% that you're talking about just now. Whereas in a living annuity, you are paying PAYE as an investor. You're not getting, the interest isn't taxable. So therefore, the cohesion between these two blocks in your portfolio, the discretionary portion and the living annuity portion, and how they interplay and how they actually cater for an income in an optimized fashion from a tax perspective, becomes an important conversation. Am I not correct?
Absolutely, Kobe, because in a living annuity, especially if you're dealing with us, there is an optimal level. There's a prudent level at which you should draw down income, and it's usually below 5%. So if the interest that you're getting is in a flexible investment and all the interest would go into an IRP 5 and you would have to pay tax on it, the whole 11%. If you're only drawing down less than 5 or 4.5 or 5% of your living annuity, that's already halving the amount of so-called interest that is in that portfolio, which would be taxed, because there are going to be other things that yield within that as well. There could be dividends, for example. There could be REIT income. Mm-hmm. There could be other things in there. You know, dividends is not, for example, taxed in our hands. But the interestingly enough as well is that dividends in a living annuity, you know, come to you with withholding tax, the 20% withholding tax that is in it. In a living annuity, in a retirement annuity, that taxation is rebated back into the fund.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It isn't taxed at the, if you look at the company tax, which is, you know, the 28 or 29% plus a 20% withholding tax, that is rebated back. So there are a lot of compelling reasons to use living annuities to bring down the tax burden that might otherwise occur in a flexible annuity. And as you were quite rightly saying, for there to be a sort of a nuanced asset allocation between the living annuity portion and the flexible portion, if that's what you've got producing income, so that you have more interest bearing, for example, more of the interest bearing assets in the living annuity and more of the growth bearing assets in flexible portfolio.
Dawn, one of the things that I've heard sometimes investors say to me is, oh, well, in that case, why don't I just put everything in the living annuity? I don't want the discretionary money. But the problem with that, as I'm sure you know, is that it doesn't take care of liquidity, big liquidity events. So once your capital is inside your living annuity, you have to draw down a steady rate of income. And you set that on the anniversary every year. There's a maximum amount that you can take out and there's a minimum amount that you can take out. But you can't ask your living annuity for an extra $500,000 or $1 million out of your living annuity. You can only do that out of a discretionary portfolio. So the optimization of this is really important, and the understanding of long-term capital and potentially the big financial obligations that are coming up in anybody's lives and making sure that there's just rainy day money available becomes critically important. So having discretionary money and then having money in a living annuity is important. Those are two sources that are very important, I think, to any individual that is trying to get to retirement.
Absolutely, Kobe. And, you know, sometimes it's a difficult conversation to have, you know, because when you do the sums and you see that a living annuity for a start, it takes that money out of the estate. So you could put a lump sum into there that is capital and put it into there, but you won't get the immediate estate effect on it because you are capped from a SARS perspective at 350K or 27.5% of your income on an annual basis in order to do that. But also once you die and that living annuity is left to your children, it will also be taxed again unless they decide to keep it on as income, which they often don't do, and you don't have control over. You can't say in your will, for example, my living annuity will be paid out to my beneficiaries as an income. They actually have the choice, and they can, for example, choose to cash it out and take up to a 36% knock on it, you know. And so if you've put capital into there willingly, and yes, you might not pay estate duty on it if you've managed to sort of whittle it down, but it's really not a sensible approach at all. You need to do the math. Somebody needs to do the math for you to say this is what it is. But having emergency liquidity or just general liquidity is a really underestimated. Cash flow is king. And you know, if you haven't got $500,000 lying around because you've got an emergency, then you have to go into debt. Mm. And that comes at a cost. And unfortunately, the older you get, you may not even get that credit.
I sat with a client, as it's supposed to be, a while ago. And this client was overseas, busy traveling, some juncture. And really speaking, this is an undemanding client from an income perspective. So there's very specific incomes that they require. And I mean, I got a call in a flat panic from overseas. I've broken something in my body and I need to go in for an op and I need liquidity. Please, can you send me X amount of money to try and help me through this process? And then that all gets facilitated and we're able to do all of that. But it just shows you that something, they slip and they fall, something happens, you need excess liquidity, you need extra liquidity, and it really isn't something that you plan for, but it is that rainy day portion that one needs to think about. Dawn, Magnificent Seven, last week I wrote about NVIDIA. I showed the volatility numbers in NVIDIA. This week you actually show the basket of the Magnificent Seven, as they're now called, and you basically show the returns. Now, between 2013 and 2019, those stocks grew at a compounded growth rate of about 15% per annum. Obviously, these are companies that are in the IT space. They're in the companies that are in the cloud space. They're companies that are obviously trying to sell artificial intelligence today and all of these good things. The interesting thing is that a lot of the rest of the market has stayed behind. In my piece that I wrote this week, I actually show that over the last 12 months, how the various components of the S&P 500 has actually performed. So the actual S&P 500, which has now got a lot of these tech companies in it, is up 14%. If you just take these tech names into consideration, that's up 35% over 12 months. Everybody would love that return, but you've got to be happy with the volatility. And once you equal weight all the companies on the S&P 500, your return becomes a very, very meager 0.9% over the last 12 months. And as a matter of fact, if you have a look over time, 64% of companies on the S&P 500 have now recorded a return of at least minus 20% since their peak in 2021. And I wonder, this bear market everybody's talking about, this recession, all of this stuff that people have been talking about, perhaps it's already happening. It's just happening in companies that you just can't see because these very large tech companies have such a large weighting in the S&P 500 that they're almost buoying the market on their own.
Yeah, and Kobe, we've said over and over again that the South African market is a mini version of that. Yeah. You know, we've got some large caps. They don't look the same. Obviously, they're not all in that tech space and everything else. But this sort of market distortion has a significant impact when you're looking at buying ETFs or trying to mimic the index and this kind of thing, or using the index as a benchmark. You're not getting the true understanding of what the portfolios are doing and what is happening in there. It can cause a lot of angst. You know, you use it as a benchmark. And unfortunately, what goes up like a rocket, you know, often comes down like a stone. And so if the NASDAQ does decide to correct, it could correct fairly significantly. It could correct as quickly on the downside as it does on the upside. I mean, that's just how markets work.
I mean, if artificial intelligence doesn't translate into the earnings profiles that many of the analysts have penciled in for these organizations, you are going to see the other side of upward volatility. You're going to see downward volatility. And downward volatility is not a fun thing to try and live through, because these stocks then just continue to lose value as they try and re-rate to a valuation point where the market is saying, okay, well, fine. I think this is kind of the point where it needs to trade. And it's in that moment we actually realize how efficient markets really are. So day to day, when you look at markets, markets actually are quite efficient. It's when you've got these very large events that happen quickly that changes the trajectory of the market. But those are often few and far between. Often when you see a stock falling 20 or 30 or 40% and you go and you do the fair value calculation, you realize everybody else has already done it. So when, I suppose one of the rules, when you see something in markets happening, it's probably already been priced in. If you think that you are this a lucky investor that has now somehow stumbled across a gem, you've got to ask yourself always the question, why are you the lucky one? Because the market's pretty efficient. They pretty much rack a lot of these things already to the prices. Well, with that, thank you very much for listening to our podcast this week. Lots more across in the newsletter. Head over to the newsletter. Go and have a read and reach out to us. It's Kirby and Dawn for Rexlom this week. Thank you for listening.